It's a group on Tuesday from 1 to 3. Who's in that group? The Tuesday group, Tuesday afternoon, 1 to 3. Is there a possibility to start already at 12:45? Or is there something which is absolutely impossible for somebody? And there's another lecture which is important to attend for the tutors, and it would be very helpful for them to start a bit early.
Would 12:30 also be okay?
Then you should find, of course, a compromise. Helping them and making things really worse for you is also not an option. But if possible, and it seems to be the case at the moment, at least I don't see any protest, then I don't mind or care. We now reserved the room between, 12 and 3 o'clock or so. I mean, 12:45 is certainly an option. The disadvantage would be that Lasse, or whoever is going to do it, needs to stop at 14:10 because he has to run away. If you start at 12:30, then it's more like open-end, and if there are questions remaining or so, there's more time. Okay, so
I would suggest we start at 12:30 then, next week, and the rest we can just discuss in the tutorial.
Okay. Next week, anyway, is a rather easy exercise. I put the sheets online yesterday in the evening, and there's one, it's called present sheet, sheet number 0, and you can play around a little bit during the Easter holidays, and it's nothing you have to submit. It's just you're going there and discussing perhaps problems or questions or anything you would like to know about quantum mechanics. And only in the second exercise, which is in the third week, we are really doing a sheet where you submit something, namely next Thursday, and also the sheet is online. And all the details you fix in that group, but as you said, let's meet at 12:30 on Tuesday. Okay, thank you very much. So usually in the first 15 minutes, I repeat what I did in the lecture before. But since we are anyway doing a repetition now, I don't think it's necessary. So I would like to immediately continue with the last remaining very short subsection, namely about time evolution. This is also something very important for this semester. For example, in 15 minutes, we'll start a new big section about time-dependent perturbation theory. And also the next, even much bigger section about scattering processes is, of course, also a time-dependent phenomenon where some particles come in and scatter and go out in time. So it's really important that we repeat this. Time evolution. The basic equation for time evolution is again the Schrödinger equation. By the way, we need the term Schrödinger equation so many times. I will now abbreviate it with SE here and in the following. And this time I mean the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which is of that form, I h bar, derivative with respect to t, then in an abstract notation. The cat psi of t, and this is identical Hamilton operator. And again, the state psi of t. And yeah, as you probably remember from quantum mechanics one, there's a huge difference between the time independent or stationary Schrödinger Gleichung, I think stationary Schrödinger equation or whatever in English, and the time dependent one. Last week, not last week, 2 days ago, I explained and showed you that the time independent Schrödinger equation can be derived from a much deeper principle, namely the commutation relations. It's more or less an eigenvalue equation. But I think this thing here, which also has the name Schrödinger equation, is a different thing. I think this is part of the axioms, again, of quantum mechanics, which say that the time evolution is basically given by the Hamilton operator. So I'm not sure or not aware that this is going back to some deeper thing. So this is an important ingredient of quantum mechanics. But on the other hand, this phenomenon that the Hamilton operator or Hamilton function leads to shifts in time, you see already in mechanics. For example, think about the Noether theorem. Not sure whether everybody covered it in mechanics, but the Noether theorem, there's a relation between symmetries and conserved quantities. And for example, a translation in time is always related with energy conservation. And turning it around, you can also use the energy to translate something in time. And this is basically also visible in quantum mechanics in terms of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. So it's not totally surprising that such an equation works. OK, in any case, this is something you need to remember, or whenever you are trying to find out how a state develops or evolves in time, you need to go back to this equation. And there are two cases, a simple one, and this is typically the case we almost always have. If the Hamilton operator is t independent, then we can, at least to some extent, solve this equation here, namely psi of t is then given by e to the power of minus I Hamilton operator, and then the time difference t minus t0, and here we have to put the state at time t0. I think it's obvious that this is a solution of this thing here. If you plug it in here and you apply the time derivative to this thing here, then since t0 is a constant, you just derive an exponential function. And yeah, by basic mathematics, I think I missed an h bar. And it's correct. The time derivative gives the Hamilton operator, which you see here, an ih bar and minus I divided by h bar eliminate each other. Of course, if the Hamilton operator itself is time dependent, for example, if you suddenly switch on an electric field or change the field by time or whatever, then it's more complicated, since this is not a solution. But as I said, it's very rarely the case, and I don't think we need it during the semester, at least not very often. Okay, so now this is a solution, but quite often it's not a very helpful solution because there's an operator acting on a state, and this is some complicated thing. So what are we going to do to make it simpler, to make the operator disappear? And yeah, this is already the last step of this subsection, to calculate psi of t you do a thing which is very common in quantum mechanics, insert one in terms of energy eigenstates so auf Deutsch einschieben eine 1 in Form von Energieeigenzuständen. I think you did it many times. And naja, this is a very straightforward calculation. Psi of t equal, now I take this expression and insert an identity. And just to remind you, an identity can be written as sum over n, where the states n must form a basis of the whole state and typically the whole space, and typically when you find the eigenstates of an operator, you have such a basis, and in our concrete application, n denotes the eigenstate of the Hamilton operator, so the solutions of the time-independent Schrödinger equation. Okay, so we take this identity, insert it, and yeah, and it looks like this, e to the minus I Hamilton operator t minus t0 divided by h bar psi of t0. And now you see why we did it, because we have the Hamilton operator and we would like to get rid of the operator, and we can always do it and typically only do it if we let it act on an eigenstate. And since we said n is an energy eigenstate, we can take this thing, pull it beyond the state, and then it becomes just a number, namely the eigenvalue. And yeah, this gives our final result. We have then sum over n, and then this complicated expression with the operator becomes just a phase dependent on the state exponential of minus I e n t minus t0 divided by h bar. Then we have a bracket, a matrix element n and psi of t0. This is just a number which you can calculate by solving the corresponding integral, or in case it's complicated, by letting the computer do numerics and produce a number. And finally, you have, of course, again a state. So basically, what this equation says is that your time evolution of psi is written as a linear superposition of energy eigenstates, and the energy eigenstates, say, come with a certain weight. The weight is, yeah, roughly speaking, given by how much of energy eigenstate n is contained in the original state psi. But then something interesting happens, namely each of these terms gets a phase, and the phase is different. For small energies, it's slowly oscillating. For large energies, it's quickly oscillating. And then something happens, which you know from physics, that there's constructive or destructive interference. And if you do it properly, you can see, for example, that in a potential, also a quantum mechanical probability distribution might go from the left to the right, like an harmonic oscillator, if the potential is shaped like this, or whatever you know from classical mechanics is in a similar way reflected in quantum mechanics, mainly due to these phases here. This is also one of the exercises, I think the last one on exercise sheet one, because in my opinion it's really nice to see or visualize it. I think the task is some simple potential. Don't remember, it's probably a square well, because it's the most easy thing. And there you prepare a particle on the left side, and you should evaluate this and then plot it with the computer, and then indeed you say see some kind of oscillation like you would expect maybe in classical mechanics. Okay, so we are done with section one. I think essentially nothing should be really new, but maybe you still learned some detailed aspects, or it was kind of a repetition for you. Are there any other questions to quantum mechanics, what you didn't understand here or in the last lecture, or maybe questions which appeared during the last year? Or shall we move on with new things? Good. Don't see any questions, and let's go to the next, or to the first big topic of this semester. So the first thing we are going to discuss is what's called time-dependent perturbation theory. again, there are two words for two quite different things, namely perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. One kind of perturbation theory you certainly discussed in quantum mechanics one, and this is time-independent perturbation theory. And time-independent perturbation theory is quite different. There you compute, I would say, energy eigenvalues and energy eigenstates. And with time-dependent perturbation theory, we are more computing what we discussed above, the time evolution of some physical process. So don't mix them up. The only thing which is similar is perturbation, and perturbation basically means that your Hamilton operator or the definition of your system has a small parameter, and we can do a Taylor expansion with respect to this small parameter. I think there the similarity ends, so it's really a different concept. Then also one remark, and I might jump back, force and back between the two options in the lecture. For example, in the introduction, I always wrote an H bar, and I also tried to consistently put hats on top of operators. In many texts, the hats are omitted, so out of the context, you have to decide yourself whether it's an operator or whether it's just a number or a function. And also quite common in theoretical physics is to set h bar and also the speed of light c to 1. And in this section, I'm going to do this. If there is doubt about whether something is an operator or not, or where an h bar comes in, please ask or do it as additional homework to correct these things. I think it's not just that I want to do it in a comfortable way. Many, in particular, more advanced texts are written like I'm going to do this section here. So it's also a training for literature. Good, so in the first subsection, we are discussing the theoretical basics of this method of time-dependent perturbation theory. And the starting point to do time-dependent perturbation theory is, first of all, a Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian H is a sum of two terms, H0 plus lambda H1. Of t. And this split is done on purpose, and H0 and A1 have to have the following properties. Schrödinger equation H0 n equal en n is solved, or maybe also easily solvable by your computer, which means eigenstates n of h0 and eigenvalues en are known. And yeah, for h1, this is a more complicated part. It can also depend explicitly on time here. This should be a weak perturbation. So the term must be small, but it can be complicated, in other words. So a typical example would be H0 can be a free particle or a particle in a box or a harmonic oscillator. This is what you all know how to solve or can look up in a quantum mechanics book. And this thing here can be an arbitrary complicated correction. For example, yeah, the corresponding v of x could be proportional to x squared. And here, this could be proportional to x to the power of 4. Then, of course, the whole thing you cannot solve. But you can solve this one here. And in case the prefactor of the second term is small, you can apply this perturbation theory to compute the time evolution of such a system with a not cubic, with a quartic term. And yeah, the idea is why this must be small. We are writing down a power series in lambda. Later in this section, we'll make more complicated and important examples from modern physics. But yeah, for the moment, really think about a simple system which you can solve in some maybe also not too complicated term, but still complicated enough that no analytical solution is known. I think this is an excellent example. And as far as I remember, it's also the first simple example I'm going to discuss in the next section. Yeah, or at least, no, it's not exactly, but it's very similar. OK, so this is a starting point. And to make more precise what you would like to compute, the problem you would like to solve is the following. The system at t equals 0 is in an eigenstate of h0. One should not say in an energy eigenstate, because it's only an eigenstate of a part of the full Hamilton operator. And yeah, typically, I use the index I for initial. It's also a very common notation in the literature. And now the task is calculate the probability to find the system at some time greater than 0 in another state, in another eigenstate of h0. And this one is typically called state f, where the f stands for final. Yeah, and this probability is denoted by P I to F. It depends on the time which passes, and it's called transition. Probability. Yeah, and this is quite a common problem in physics. Typically, we are talking about exciting a system or decay of a system. Standard example in quantum mechanics books, which we are not going to discuss in the lecture, is, for example, an atom. Take a hydrogen atom. This you can solve analytically, and then you put this atom in some electric or magnetic field, and then there might be a transition between different energy levels of this the hydrogen atom without an electric or magnetic field. And this you can compute. If we develop a formalism which can do this, you can give the probabilities set for a given electric field, which is then contained in H1. Can determine the probabilities that, for example, the hydrogen atom goes from the ground state to the first excited state or to the second excited state or to some particular angular momentum or spin state you're interested in. So this is quite often in experimental physics the case when you play around with atoms and molecules, etc. Also in particle physics, which is closer to my own research, this is very important. Probably you have heard about hadrons and that many hadrons are not stable and can decay. For example, a pion, which is a light and common meson, does not live forever. It quickly decays into a neutrino and an electron. And also this transition you can compute with time-dependent perturbation theory. And I'm quite sure in any other field of physics, solid state physics and optics, there are also many examples of decays or excitations, in a certain sense, changes of a system with respect to time, which can be calculated quite accurately with time-dependent perturbation theory if the perturbation is weak. Usually this, or quite often the perturbation is put in from hand, then of course you can make it weak, like putting a weak electric field or a weak magnetic field, or sometimes, like in particle physics, you need to be lucky. Typically in particle physics, the perturbation is the weak interactions, and the name already says that the weak interactions have a very, very small coupling constant, and that's also an excellent approximation. Okay, so this is what we like to do. Now some technical steps. The first thing is exactly what we repeated at the beginning of this lecture. We would like to compute probabilities, transition probabilities, which depend on t. So we need the time evolution. And as we said a few minutes ago, the time evolution is given by the time-dependent Schrödinger equation I dt ψ psi of t equal h psi of t. And our initial conditions are the following: psi of t equals 0 is the state I, again, it's an eigenstate of H0. And with this, we can easily write down the expression for the probability we would like to determine. The probability to have a transition from initial state I to final state F after time t is nothing else. Now, again, you need to think about what we repeated 2 days ago. What is a probability to find a system in a certain state? It's the bracket of the state with the eigenstate you would like to find the system, and the whole thing squared. So it's the final state with the state at time t and the whole thing squared. And at first glance, maybe this thing appears that only the final state enters, but this is of course not true, because here we have the time evolution, and the time evolution is given by those two equations, not only by the Schrödinger equation, but also by the initial conditions. And in the initial conditions, obviously, the state I enters, so the whole result depends, as it should, on the initial state, on the final state, and also, of course, on the time which passes. So this thing we need to compute, and this is, of course, not so easy, because the time evolution is given by the full Hamilton operator, and the full Hamilton operator contains this piece here, which is not analytically calculable. Otherwise, of course, we wouldn't do perturbation theory, but immediately write down the solution. And basically, we are now developing a formalism to get this thing here as a power series in lambda. Now the next step is again very similar to what we did in the beginning of the lecture, to solve. Here's the Schrödinger equation, which is equation 22 in my notes. Expand in terms of eigenstates of H0. So again, not in terms of energy eigenstates, only in terms of these eigenstates we can compute easily and which we know. And if we do it, then psi of t is a sum over n, cn of t, e to the minus I e n t n. Here, this looks already like a solution, but in fact, it's not any solution. It's just a convenient form of writing the whole thing, because this cn of t is at the moment completely unknown. The only thing which we used at the moment is that any state can be written as a superposition of a basis of states, and the basis is now the set of energy eigenstates of H0, and this one is just a prefactor. It's convenient to include this phase, we will see in a minute why, And the whole rest, which we have no idea how it looks, it's just called Cn of t. So a function depending on t and a function different for any of these states Cn. So clearly, for any point in time and any possible psi, we can find coefficients. Such this thing here is correct, but it's not helpful in any sense that we can make at the moment a prediction. The task will now be to set up equations which allow us to obtain these unknown Cn's. Yeah, maybe some remark why this here is convenient. It's so because Cn of t is delta In for lambda equals 0. What this means is if we turn off our perturbation, we just have the completely solvable system, the easy system described by the Hamilton operator H0. And for such a thing, we know the time evolution. This is what we did 20 minutes ago or so. If we know the energy eigenstates and if H is not time dependent, then the time evolution is just given by this phase here. And N needs to be I, roughly speaking, the state in which the system is prepared. Therefore, Cn has a very simple form, delta In for lambda equals 0. And since lambda is rather small, doing this choice here in a certain sense provides also small coefficient Cn or corrections to this thing here. Or in other words, having included this phase, we already have a very good starting point or approximation for the coefficients we are looking for, and we don't want to calculate explicitly or start with anything else, with exception of these stellar functions here. Yeah, maybe this was not the best explanation, partly because of my not so excellent English. Was this clear or confusing? Please ask when something is not clear. There were not many questions, I think. Not even one question today, and not sure whether there was a question last time. Particularly in these Wahlpflicht lectures, we can have many discussions. It's not the aim to whatever discuss all details and all sections I've prepared. You should rather learn something. Okay. In any case, it's not necessary. It's rather a convenient thing. The solution is a bit simpler. We could also ignore it and develop the same formalism, but it makes our life a little bit more simple. Still, if lambda is not zero, then the coefficient Cn will not be delta In, they might be similar, but now we need to set up or find equations how to determine these corrections. And this is what we are doing now. We study the left and the right hand side again of equation 22. The left-hand side is the time derivative of psi of t. And this thing here, this ansatz, where the unknown coefficients are now included, needs to be inserted. Then we have I dt sum over n cn of t e to the minus I e n t n, and the time derivative we can easily apply. There are two time dependent things. First the cn, then the phase. So we need to apply the product rule for differentiation. And this is sum over n I dt cn of t. I can pull out the phase. This is the first term, and the second term is derivative acting on the phase. And this just gives a factor proportional to En, which can be written in the following form, En Cn of t. So this is not so difficult, just ordinary differentiation. And then similar calculation, right-hand side of 22. So we let the Hamilton operator act on psi and insert this expression for psi. I just copy it so that we see better what's going to happen. Now, now we need to keep in mind what h is. H is h0 plus lambda h1. H0 is quite simple. I can exchange an operator h0 with an ordinary function, with another ordinary function, and then it acts on n. N is an eigenstate with respect to h0. So applying h0 to n replaces the h0 by just the eigenvalue en. So this is the first term now, sum over n en. I just need to copy the unknown coefficient cn and also the phase. Yeah, and then the more complicated term, or the term we cannot simplify right away, is the operator h1. The operator h1, yeah, can at the moment only be formally applied to n. We can exchange it with the coefficient again, with the phase, because these are functions. But yeah, we can not write much else than lambda cn of t h1 of t. Good. So now, of course, left-hand side is identical to right-hand side. And this means that this red thing is identical to that red thing. And now one term appears on the left and on the right-hand side, namely here and here, is the same thing. So we can just erase it on the left and the right-hand side, and the equation is still correct. Yeah, and going to write it down. What we have found by this calculation is I sum over n dt cn of t e to the minus I en t n. So this is what's coming from the left-hand side, and what remains on the right-hand side is also a sum over n cn of t e to the minus I en h 1 of t and n. Good, this is still a bit too complicated in particular because there are on the left and on the right hand side sums, but this sum can easily be eliminated. In particular on the left hand side, we only have a function, an unknown function, a phase, which is also a function, but there's no operator. So the only or most complicated object on the left hand side is the eigenstate n. And as I said, there's a sum over all eigenstates. And if you have ever such a construct in quantum mechanics, you can easily eliminate the sum by multiplying from the left-hand side with an appropriate state or bra, namely with another eigenstate of H0. Let's call it state M. And then, of course, the bra M can be exchanged with the sum, with these functions, and then you have the bracket mn. And the bracket mn, as you should know and probably know, is nothing else than delta mn. So it's either 1 when the two states are identical, or 0 if they are different. So basically, all the terms in the sum disappear with exception of one thing, and this drastically simplifies this equation. This we are still doing, and after that, we have a short break. Multiply with bra m, and as I explained, the left hand side not much survives, namely only the time derivative of cm, and on the right hand side we have lambda sum over n cn of t e to the power of plus I em minus en t, and then a matrix element m h1 of t n. Two remarks. We started with this one here, and I said that the state disappears and the sum breaks down. This is, of course, correct. Just keep in mind that the phase also survives, of course, but I brought it to the other side, and therefore here the phase factor is slightly more different. It's the plus I em, which is coming from the left-hand side. And the second thing, which is also maybe worth mentioning, is that this multiplication with m is not so helpful on the right-hand side. And the reason is that on the right-hand side, there's still an operator h1. On the left-hand side, there's only a state n. But on the right-hand side, when I multiply with bra m, I can exchange the state, the bra, with the sum, with lambda, with cn, with the phase, but I cannot pull it past the operator h1. Therefore, we get such a complicated bracket, what's also often called matrix element in quantum mechanics. And this, of course, needs to be computed or further investigated. So I would say this is now the challenging part which we need to consider. But still, we have I would say, already drastically simplified the whole thing. It's now a set of differential equations for the unknown coefficients Cm, which is not too difficult. It's just an exponential function. And of course, these numbers are complicated things which depend on operators and states. Okay, so let's have a 5 minutes break and we continue then. Okay, so now we derived an equation. It's equation 28 in the notes, and now we would like to solve this equation. And solving it in closed form is not possible, at least not possible for a non-trivial H1. But what we can do now is perturbation theory, which is nothing else than a Taylor expansion and solving the set of equations order by order. And this is what we are doing now, or what this ansatz is about, to solve this system here of coupled differential equations. Have a look at it. It's clearly a set of differential equations because you have a derivative on the right-hand side of an unknown function and the unknown function without a derivative on the left-hand side. It's also a coupled system because we have many functions Cm which we need to determine at the same time. At the same time because the right-hand side is a sum over all these functions. So this is exactly what's a system of coupled differential equations. And to solve this system of equations, write Cn of t as power series in lambda, which is Cn of t is sum j equals 0 to infinity lambda to the power of j Cn j of t. So this is nothing else than an ordinary one-dimensional Taylor expansion for every Cn and every point in time, which means that we don't only have the j's coefficient, but the j's coefficient for every n, and it's also a function with respect to time. But with exception of this, it's a power series in lambda, and of course, the higher powers become less and less important because the starting point was that lambda is small, and now we can insert this thing here, sort according to powers of lambda, and solve it to the order of lambda 0, then lambda to the power of 1. And in principle, what we are not going to do here, but you can do, is lambda to the power of 2. And I guess then in practice, I've never seen any higher thing. You can certainly do it, but I'm not sure whether it's often done. So let's consider the leading order. The leading order solution of 28 is in order lambda to the power of 0. So this is not very interesting, but we need to start with it. Lambda to the power of 0 is equivalent to lambda equals 0. So it's not anymore on the board. Here you see it a bit, but it means that we have just the original unperturbed problem given by H0. So this is really not so interesting, but still we need to write it down as a starting point. when we look what kind of coefficients have a factor lambda to the power of zero, then not so much is remaining. Of course, the left-hand side, but the right-hand side completely disappears because any term on the right-hand side has at least one lambda coming from here and possibly more lambdas due to the Cn. And what I said was also not quite correct. The left-hand side doesn't completely survive because we also have a Cm, and C is a power series in lambda, so only the zeroth order of the Cms survive here on the left-hand side. Okay, so let's write it down. It's I dt Cm 0 of t equals 0. This is everything that remains of the set of equations 28. It's very nice because suddenly they are decoupled. For every index m, we have a different differential equation, and it's also a very simple one. It just says the derivative of Cm is 0, which means that Cm of 0 of t is a constant. Naja, and also the constant, we can immediately provide the correct ones, namely what fixes the constants are now the initial conditions. The initial conditions is psi of t equals 0 equal initial state I. No, it's not anymore on the board, but it was part of our starting point. And now we need to look where probably this equation here is good. Psi of t equals 0. If we insert t equals 0, since the phase goes away, we have just sum over n cn of t and n. Naja, and when it must be the initial state I, then clearly also on the right-hand side, only the coefficient ci can survive, and it must be the identity, so a factor of 1 multiplied with this, otherwise the initial condition would not be fulfilled. So the consequence of these considerations is that Cm0 of t is not only a constant, but particular constants, namely delta I am.
And why do we set the lambda 0?
No, we don't set lambda to 0. It's the zeroth power of lambda.
Okay, and then why the second line is 0? Yeah.
Here, it's this set of equations, and we, for every term, we check or we sort according to powers of lambda. And when you look at the right-hand side, there's a global prefactor of lambda, so the lowest order in lambda is at least lambda to the power of 1. There's no term which has no lambda. Therefore, lambda to the power of 0 has no contribution from the right-hand side. As we did here for the coefficient Cn, in principle, we are doing the same thing here. We expand or write both the left and the right-hand side as a power series in lambda. So formally, I could maybe it's clearer when I do the second order, the first order, the a second example, and then it's probably easy to understand. Give me 1 minute, and then I come back to your question. So now, solution of 28 order lambda to the power of 1. And now, again, we look at this thing here and find all terms which carry exactly 1 power of lambda as a prefactor. And the left-hand side is I dt c m 1 of t. So I and dt have no lambda, of course. Cn is written in a power series of lambda. We are looking for all terms having exactly 1 power of lambda, which means lambda to the power of 1, j equal 1. So all the coefficients cn with an index 1, with an upper index 1, survive here. And on the right-hand side, again, we are looking for terms linear in lambda. And here we already have 1 lambda. So we may not pick up any other lambda. And the only chance here is to set or to put in the zeros order in lambda. So this expansion here, the coefficient cn 0. I write it down. It's sum over n cn of 0 of t e to the plus I em minus en t m h1 of t n. Did this already help a bit, or you're still confused? I mean, the structure is not, I mean, when you once got it, it's really easy to see or to understand what happens. We have, from our equation, we would like to solve 1 power of lambda on the right-hand side. So basically, the coefficients, the index of the coefficients here and here will always differ by 1. So the zeros order is, as we said, quite trivial. We have constants for the C0 contribution. And then the next equation is an equation for the C1s. But the C1s are much easier to determine than the whole thing, because we insert 1 order lower. And 1 order lower, for example, is only a constant. I'll do it in the next line. And then we solve for C1. And if we would do second order, then we would have here a C2 and here C1s. We would reuse our result from the first order calculation. And we could iterate and iterate until it's precise enough. OK? Yeah. This is a bit lengthy, but as I just said, we now can take our result and plug it in here. So it's just delta in. And this makes things, of course, much simpler, because the sum breaks down. And we have e to the power of I E M minus E I T M H I. Yeah, and then we again need to look at the initial conditions. Initial conditions, or condition psi of t equals 0 is I, and what I already marked here for the zeros order, we should or need to look at equation 24. Initial condition plus equation 24 gives the following final result for our first order coefficients, Cm1 of t equal minus I integral from 0 to t dt e the power of plus I em minus ei t prime m h1 of t prime and I. I think not too much actually happened here. It's a time derivative, it's this thing here. So C is obviously the integral with respect to time. It's clear that you can invert the derivative with an integration. And the initial conditions, I think, are only there or mentioned that it's done in a proper way. Basically, what we, I think, need to realize with this equation is that at t equals 0, all these coefficients vanish, because at t equals 0, the state did not do any time evolution. It's still the state I. The state I is already completely taken into account by the zeros order. So the fact that when t equals 0, that the integral is going from 0 to 0 and nothing is generated by the integration immediately fixes our initial conditions. But of course, when the time becomes larger and larger, then the integrand and also this matrix element, which we do not know at the moment, picks up a certain contribution, and this then changes the state, and will immediately express the probabilities we are looking for also by the Cn's. So this is already a very important equation here. I already used blue. To summarize, in case you're not interested in this theoretical formalism, just in applying time-dependent perturbation theory, I would say these two equations here is what you need to use in practice, and to give it a meaning, you also need to take that equation into account, basically summing the results of the two equations here to obtain Cn. And finally, the Cn must be translated to something where we can do concrete calculations, namely the state as a function of t. So those four equations are needed for time-dependent perturbation theory in practice. And basically, this is just bookkeeping. And those two are the results for the unknown coefficients. Zeros order is trivial. And here, you need to solve an integral. Okay. Yeah, now the bad thing is that actually I need, or it would be nice to have also this board still available. I think these are technical steps which are not so important anymore. I already told you with these results we can compute in perturbation theory now the time evolution, but the problem we wanted to solve, or one typically wants to solve, is to compute these transition probabilities, because they can be measured in an experiment, and theoretical physics is always about doing a calculation which can be compared to experiment or can predict an experiment. So the remaining thing, but this is not very difficult, is to express the transition probabilities in terms of the coefficient C and maybe our perturbative result. So transition probability P I F of T is just copied from the left hand side, the amplitude or the matrix element F psi of T squared. And now we take this expansion, plug it in, and then a very simple result comes out, Cf of t squared, because psi is expanded in terms of eigenstates of h0, and these are not operators, just functions. So similarly, as we had 20 minutes ago, when we tried to simplify this set of equations for C, we again have a multiplication from the left-hand side and from the right-hand side of two states from the same orthogonal set. And then it's N and F which are multiplied. And of course, this gives a delta NF, which means that only one coefficient survives, namely the CF, and also the phase goes away, because the phase can be, is essentially eliminated by the absolute value. I can write a product of two functions when I take the absolute value as absolute value of one and the other function, and the absolute value of a phase is of course one. So I think it's not simple mathematics, but you're also already well educated in theoretical physics, so I guess you see why this is immediately simplified to CF. And now we do perturbation theory. Basically, we insert what we have computed, and this is also not a very deep thing. We have CF of 0 plus lambda CF1 of t plus order lambda squared, and the whole thing taking the absolute value n squared. And this is not a big thing. It's here's the expansion of Cn in terms of the Cnj. It's basically exactly the right-hand side, which I've written here, but in a more explicit form, namely what we have computed now above or where we have concrete expressions plus omitting all higher terms. And as the name says, perturbation theory means that lambda is small. And when lambda is small enough, having this one and set one here is quite a good approximation. As I said, in books, typically also the second order is done in the same way. So if you're looking for a challenge over the Easter holidays, try to derive it by yourself and then consult a book. Probably you can go on to third and fourth and whatever order, but at least I haven't seen it before. So it seems to be common either to use the first order or the second order. Usually we are really interested in a transition going from I to F, where I is not identical to F, and then this thing simplifies even further because CF0 is delta IM, and this means it's identical to zero if I is unequal F. Therefore, we make another special case. We make the most common case. We exclude one special case. So we say, what is a transition probability for I unequal F? And then we have, of course, the same result, but as I said, CF is delta IM, delta IF, and when I is unequal F, this thing here vanishes. So we have lambda CF 1 of t plus order lambda squared. And now we insert what we have computed here. And this is lambda square and it's an absolute value of our time integral e to the plus I EF minus EI T prime F H1 of T prime I squared plus order lambda to the power of 3. Now I would say this is a central equation which we wanted to derive, for which is the main message from this section 2.1. If you are interested only in the practical application, it's probably sufficient to remember or to use this yellow equation. Again, you can compute the transition from a state I to F, where I and F are eigenstates of the unperturbed Hamiltonian of H0. And the transition is generated by the correction or perturbation H1. And to do it, you need to compute this matrix element here. A matrix element is nothing else than a scalar product. For example, when you have a wave function for F and for I and a concrete expression for H1, it's an integral like you know from quantum mechanics 1. So for example, it could look like this, integral dx, and then how do we call these functions, psi f star of x, and then h1 psi I of x. So this can in principle be calculated. And everything else is at least not extremely difficult. Maybe you cannot do the integral analytically. It depends a bit on H1 and everything. But again, you need to include a phase, integrate, take the absolute value, and this gives you the transition probability. And keep in mind that it's only a perturbative result, so it might receive, of course, a correction, lambda to the power of 3, 4, and so on. And if lambda is big, this is a very bad approximation. If lambda is small, then it becomes a better and better and better approximation. Yeah, we have 5 minutes left. I don't think it's a good idea to start the example, which is the next section. I use the time to say 2 more things. The first is already a bit about the example. I mean, when this thing was now a bit abstract today, and if you would like to do calculations, so again, briefly here about a possible example, then take one-dimensional quantum mechanics and for H0, the harmonic oscillator. Then all the wave functions are known, or even simpler, you use the creation and annihilation operators. And for example, you can easily compute such a matrix element in this formalism because what I've written here is phi is known. And if you provide any perturbation, it could be a polynomial like proportional to x or proportional to x to the power of 4 or whatever you like. This is a very standard integral. And then you can perform explicit calculations. And this is what I'm going to do in the next lecture to show that this indeed is useful in praxis. The other remark is already about the oral exam. I mean, typically in this lecture, we have rather long derivations. Today, in fact, it was very short. For example, when I think about scattering theory, probably we are developing for many weeks complicated equations. And I mean, when you're coming to the oral exam, it should not be your goal to learn these things with all signs, etc. I mean, I don't remember them, and I don't prepare specifically for the exam. I only ask what I remember, and what I remember and what also you should remember are more the basic concepts and crude ways to arrive at these things. I mean, when you summarize for yourself today's lecture, important is, of course, to understand, and what was, for example, also asked, how this expansion in terms of lambda for the state, for the coefficient, for the set of equation works. Of course, if you have no idea what the final result looks like, it's also not good. Maybe you should remember that we are after a transition probability. Maybe you should remember that the leading order is lambda square, that some integral is contained. But whether it's a plus or minus here, or whether I or F is here or here, this is indeed not so important. So it's probably different from quantum mechanics one, where all the things were quite easy to calculate and rather short. Here it's more lengthy, but try to keep the view from above on what we are really doing and don't get lost in the tiny details, because they won't help for the exam, because when we are at the exam, I have already forgotten what I did on the board, at least the details. Yeah, this only as an advice. If there are no more questions, then we continue next Tuesday at 10:15.